Hello and welcome to the Modern Romantic Podcast, where we celebrate and inspire romanticism through passionate people doing incredible things. Hi, I promise I'm practicing my scales. I promise. Hi, I'm Trey. And we are joined by the host of today's show, Emily. Hi, Emily.
Hello. I'm not practicing my scales, but I do believe in having some ray a drop of golden sun.
Oh, I see what you did there.
Okay, good. I'm glad it was not lost on you.
I feel like our guest is chuckling a little bit at this. So would you do us the honor of introducing our fantastic guest this evening?
I would. Yes, ladies and gentlemen, it is my great pleasure to introduce our esteemed guest for today's episode, pianist and Sona Chamber Music Director, Tomoko Kashiwangi.
Great. Thank you so much for having me on the program.
Thank you for coming on the show. Sorry, we're just going to talk over each other. Sorry. Thank you for being here. We're very excited to talk to you, and we're going to have a great time. Yeah.
Sounds great.
What were you going to say, Trey?
I was really, for me, and I want our listening audience to know, that you do so much when it comes to music. But every musician has to start somewhere. So my question for you is, how did you get into music and how did you get to be where you are today?
Great. Well, I was hoping you would ask that because I was talking to a friend of mine recently where both of us are pianists. And at one point in our life, when we were actually students, a doctorate student at University of Texas at Austin, I was so, determined to be a collaborative pianist. And there is a degree. I'm the first recipient of the Doctorate of Musical Arts in Collaborative Piano from University of Texas at Austin.
Wow.
So I was like, okay, I'm going to do this thing called collaborative piano, and I'm going to make sure that everybody knows. But, I have been in Fayetteville, Arkansas now for 12 years. I have been a faculty here since 2012. And recently when I visited a friend of mine from UT Austin days, we both said, I just want to be known as a pianist or a musician rather than being a certain thing, because that's what I end up doing now. I still play solo piano. I'm a collaborative pianist, meaning I play in ensembles. Like I play with Sona, I play in orchestra. I have my own chamber music series, and I'm really enjoying curating and growing that program. But then I also teach students. I like to play with whoever. It was kind of a full circle moment where I said, oh, I'm just the musician who ended up playing a piano. So just to kind of go back to all the way back to the beginning, I'm originally from Japan. So thank you so much for being so considerate and asking me how to pronounce my name. I have been in the United States for more than half my life. I'm originally from Japan, but I ended up spending some years of my childhood in Detroit, Michigan, because my father was in the automobile parts business. It was late 80s, all the Japanese cars were coming to US. So when I was 10, when I was in third grade, it was kind of a sudden announcement. We're going to America. I did not know alphabet. I think my father ended up coming to US before the family, the rest of us. And when I first came, I remember still the first day at elementary school in the US, I didn't know how to write alphabet yet. And I think the teacher really wanted to be kind. And during, break, snack time, he had an apple in his hand. I can't imagine this being allowed now, but he had a pocket knife. He split the apple in half and then handed it to me, and I started crying, going like, oh my goodness, this person has a knife and he just split the apple in his hand. And I went home after that. I had my mom pick me up. So my first impression of US was like, what what is going on here?
Scary. That's scary.
Scary. But I think that kind of experience, we ended up staying in Detroit area for 4.5 years.
Okay.
That kind of got me, you know, speaking English early on. So that was eventually turned out to be a good thing. I went back, my family went back home to Japan when I was 14 years old. And I spent the rest of my childhood in Japan. When I got to high school and thinking about college, the option was, do I go into music or, as my parents wanted me to, be like a translator? You know, you speak English, you do work. but luckily for me, throughout me growing up, without me or my parents really focusing on music. My parents are not they like music, but they're not musicians. I'm a middle child. I have an older sister and a younger sister. We ended up playing piano because that's what all good girls in that era did. Everybody learn piano or violin, especially in Japan. You know, it's nice. I love that it was music education or musical training was part of my growing up, but it's definitely was not my parents' plan at that point. But throughout these several stages, coming from Japan, starting the piano around 6 years old and coming to the US and finding a teacher from a local music store, to going back home to Japan. I think I was really lucky. I don't think my parents went out of the way to find the best teacher in town, but the teachers who has been in my life has been the best that I could ever hope for. They kind of prepared me, I think, without me really wanting or thinking, but they, you know, had me practice my scales and they had me learning a lot of different pieces and music and I think growing me, which made it possible at that point in high school when I was faced with the decision, what do I do with, you know, after high school? I was ready, or my teacher told me, well, you speak English already. If you want to do piano, you can actually go and try to go study abroad. So I ended up coming to Indiana University, which is a really big music school. Mm-hmm. I believe when I came in, I guess age is not a secret for me. I came to study undergraduate in 1997.
Okay.
That time, Indiana University School of Music was already one of the largest music program in the US for classical training. And I spent wonderful years there, almost 9 years. I ended up doing undergraduate, master's degree, and a performer diploma. And then during that time, all my teachers were really great. I had great influence. It was because it was such a big school. I also had to play with many people. There was an opera that many of the singers were auditioning for MAD, and there were several full-size orchestras that we could listen to. It's in the middle of Norway, almost, especially when I come from, you know, a suburb of Tokyo. Okay. Yeah. Bloomington, Indiana is kind of in the middle of the cornfield, as we like to say.
I know where that is because I grew up near Chicago.
Yeah, and it's great because in terms of school music, it's so comprehensive. It has the best music library. It has, you know, undergraduate to doctorate people, students, and the faculty were fabulous. And so I landed in such a great place where I can just kind of be protected and also focus, especially since I wasn't really focused before coming to to Indiana. I think that kind of put me in an environment where I thought, oh, I really need to step up my game if I want to do this as my career and my future. And so from there, let's see, I ended up with a master's degree in piano performance, and I had a few years where I kind of wondered. I didn't know what I was going to do. I taught some younger students, and that gave me a visa to stay in the US a little bit longer. Ended up in Chicago for a few years, and then eventually decided I needed a doctorate if I wanted to have a teaching degree or something associated with the university. So I went to University of Texas at Austin, like I said at the beginning. I have the first doctorate in collaborative piano from UT Austin. And then after that, I was looking for a place to teach or be more involved, and found a job at University of Arkansas. And I'm happily here for the past 12 years and looking forward to growing some more things in this area.
Wonderful.
What a great story. And sorry, getting a little tongue-tied here, but I love that you said at the beginning how you wanted to be known as a musician, and that it's by saying musician, it still encompasses that you are a solo performer, you perform with ensembles, you have your own chamber series. And I think that reflects your journey through music. And I think that helps recognize all of those different aspects of what makes you such a fantastic musician.
Thank you. And also, I didn't mention it, but all this time, also growing up, I keep telling similar stories to people that I encounter. And you know, when I have to explain what is collaborative piano or why do I even like doing this, I've never taken official lessons other than piano lessons. I've never been, you know, taking lesson as a singer or other things. But being in the U.S. when I was seventh grade, that time, music in middle school is banned. So I ended up taking up clarinet for a while. I played clarinet in band. Looking back, I guess I can't remember being outcast or like not fitting in, but I guess I didn't fit in that well, because I do remember during those middle school years in Detroit, one of the schools in the suburb, I ended up spending most of my lunch hours in the band room. And I remember the teacher's name. I remember her letting me just come into the band room and, you know, putting my clarinet together and just playing for the rest of the lunch hour. So I guess I didn't have a whole lot of students, other friends to hang out with, and clarinet was my friend that time. But that gave me a place to belong. And when I went back home to Japan, I continued clarinet in the middle school or junior high for a little bit. But then when I got to high school, I really, really wanted to try playing a string instrument. So in Japan, in high schools, there's kind of a extracurricular club, after school club kind of thing. Okay. Mm-hmm. And I joined chamber music club and I picked up viola. I was too old to start a violin or cello. So I thought, ooh, I can surely play a viola. And I was probably not a good violist, but I still have my viola that I bought back then. I waited table during one of the winter breaks to buy myself a viola, and it's still here with me.
Wonderful.
So that gave me a little bit of experience playing string instrument. And then all those years, of course, Japanese being karaoke, you know, we all sing, and I sang in choirs. And like I said, I never had a formal teacher, but I kind of enjoyed being a part of music in different with different instrument, different capacities. And I look back thinking, wow, that must have surely contributed to why I like doing what I'm doing now. It gives me at least some kind of understanding of what a string player would feel like, or what a woodwind, you know, instrument would feel like. I didn't plan it, but I guess I am where I am because of everything I've done in the past. And I feel pretty good about how I feel very lucky that it ended up being right for me.
When it comes to the collaborative piano, what are some considerations that you have doing that versus when you're solo performing? I'm kind of thinking for someone who may not have experienced a collaborative pianist, I kind of wanting to give a little bit of insight for those listeners.
Of course. So collaborative piano, we still play piano, and sometimes this is a kind of a view that some people had, especially maybe 50 years ago. Pianists who were doing collaborative work was kind of a second area, second level, not as good. People who were thought of as not being able to perform solo repertoire would be an accompanist. And of course, that label or the notion came just because I think because some, of course, a violinist, a very good violinist, would be asked to play a concert and say, oh, they need to play this piece, but it has a piano part. Well, let's hire up somebody who can play along with this, the features artist. And it's, I think there are places or pieces like that too. But then if you go way back, let's say into the time of Beethoven, a really, a composer that we cherish, Beethoven wrote sonatas, music for piano and violin. If you look at the title page, the piano comes first and actually the violin is second. It doesn't mean, it's not a ranking. It's just that the mindset, I think, of the composer, they didn't write for this person first and then somebody just filling in the blanks or the rest. And I think it's a commercial thing where some management who want to sell tickets featuring this star soloist ended up putting the other people's name in a smaller font size. And I think that became a thing. But so when I started thinking about collaborative piano or how much I enjoy playing chamber music, especially when I was in school, like in undergraduate, actually I had a teacher who I adore and I owe so much of my musicianship to him. But he did say, don't go into chamber music. Be a solo pianist who will play chamber music. And I think even for him, the mindset was like, be the best musician, which is a solo, who can play solo repertoire. And then, of course, you'll get asked to do other things. But if you were just doing this accompanying chamber music thing, you'll never get asked to do a solo. And for that part, I do think maybe there was a trend back, like I said, many, many years. But now I don't think that's true. And when I say collaborative piano or chamber music, and I play with somebody else, the music making becomes, I think, bigger of my awareness. My ears are more focused on my partners because how I would react to them, how I play my parts are so influenced by what they do. And it is supposed to be conversational, it through sound, not necessarily talking, but while we're playing, if I phrase something a certain way, if I have a really good partner, they would phrase it back. So it's literally like conversation through sound. And I think that is such a different awareness as we're playing. And sometimes it's harder because you still want to play all your notes right. You want to do all your things right, but you're having to focus on somebody else. And so it's almost like multitasking and doing everything better. I feel like since I've become more collaboratively aware, I think my solo playing got better because now I'm thinking more in multiple dimension. Even when I only have two hands, I can hear, oh, this is like a singer, and I'm the pianist, that I'm the collaborative pianist here, and then I still have a cello line in between, and I can have a lot more fun kind of feeling out the layers. So I guess I don't want to say role playing by myself, but I get to do that a little bit in my mind at least. I think it's fun.
It sounds fun.
Yeah.
And how amazing that you have found something that is work, but also art, and you have fun. I think that's brilliant.
Thank you.
Yeah.
We were talking before the show where you had sent a student right before the episode back to practice their scales. And it makes me kind of think about people who have difficulty keeping with music. How do you get them to have fun while making music? How do you inspire them?
That's a really great question. And I don't know if I have all the answers, but one of the things that I'm really, really passionate and I'm still searching, but I feel like I have more friends who agree. We teach students and we say, that's a right note, that's a wrong note. That is the right rhythm, that's the wrong rhythm. And of course, there's that, right? But then the part that I want to bring back is we miss some play in playing music. Like you said, when I was growing up and I just played, you know, I didn't think about being a musician. I wanted to play all the right notes and make music and feel good about it. But then the focus, at least that point, at least for me, it wasn't like how many right notes I play, you know, and I had fun with it. I'm sure my teachers were really sometimes frustrated because I was maybe playing too much with it. And maybe it wasn't as according to what it says on the music. But, you know, I was able to put some fun. I had fun with it. And I think for some musicians and some students or people who has walked away from music for a while, and there are many who especially parents of my students or some acquaintance, they would say, oh, I used to play music, I used to play the piano, I used to play flute. And I say, would you like to play again? Oh, I'm, you know, of course, time and life, other things, that's important things, and priorities change throughout our lives. But especially when grown-ups come back to play, they have such expectation. It's the expectation and matching it that sometimes takes away some of the fun, because you know that you play a wrong note, it sounds wrong. But what I hope, or what I try to do is to say, well, playing the this is something that actually a cello teacher has told me. Playing the right note with the wrong intention does not make it right. You know, playing, because we are also athlete in a way when we play piano and we try to make a leap and make sure that we land. If we play a wrong note, but with the right kind of sound, sometimes it's okay. It's not wrong, but it's musical. It's musical, but you step on something and maybe it's not as clean. Maybe it's not CD worthy, but I'm not trying to make a CD. We're just trying to make some music and we're just trying to have a conversation. I say so many things and I have to backtrack and rephrase something. And that's, you know, it's just part of communication. So just kind of giving that safe environment to say, let's not worry about notes. We'll do the best we can, but let's see if we can keep this groove going together. If you get off, come back in, you know, join the fun again, and let's see if we can get to the end somehow. I think that's the first goal, especially for somebody, like you said, who's not, you know, who's doing music for fun. I think that's really important. To change that mindset about how many notes you play right. It's music, and you know, it's just like communicating. There's many ways to do it.
I love that. I love that outlook on it. And it's interesting because I've heard that before, but it was in relation to singing. And it was, mm-hmm. I think it was Christina Aguilera that said, you know, it doesn't have to be the right note, but if you make it gritty or you make it you know, emotional, that it's not going to matter, and that mm-hmm. that makes it more authentic and more genuine.
Mm-hmm. I think that's really true too, the genuine part. Of course, if I'm performing and if I'm making a recording with a colleague or something, it needs to be note perfect. But then it's always the back and forth between let's make it note perfect and, you know, just, I don't want to say it, but let's nail that note, make sure that it's there. But then just making sure that it's also musically there and just figuring out how can I make sure, be more secure about playing that note in a musical manner. And, you know, it takes time and sometimes we still fail. We might play 99 times right. And then in that moment of pressure or really wanted to make a good impression or play beautifully, things happen and that's life. And that doesn't make me a bad musician. I think I really come back to that saying, I'm just a musician. I'm not a robot. I do make mistakes and I hope I make beautiful mistakes.
I can love somebody that. Clip that, please?
Yeah, I was thinking that too. we need that. For sure.
And I have to say, what a refreshing take on that. When I was going through music degrees and going in performance, there was such an emphasis on technique and really, for me, what translated as getting the note right. So for me to hear, let's make beautiful mistakes, but let's also work on that communication. And if we have to rephrase this a few times in order to get it right, but still make it musical, then so be it. So that is really refreshing for me to hear.
Thank you. And I think as I was thinking about, you know, speaking to both of you and if there was something that I would like to share and if anybody would have comments that I would always, I'm still searching for the right answer for me. And of course, answers are different for everybody, especially for art, right? Because mm-hmm. it's such just personal.
Yes.
I do struggle once in a while saying, you know, my teachers back then, they said, you know, strive to be a solo pianist. You know, that's how you get better. Of course, we're in also, I feel like post-COVID, we are also very aware of healing and making sure that we feel good about ourselves. But part of being an artist is, you know, that pushing to be better. So I struggle saying, okay, I'm good enough, but can I be better? That means I have to think that I'm not good enough. You know, you have to think that you can be better, meaning I'm not there yet. And so it's always that tug of war of, oh, like, should I just say I'm good enough? I should feel good about myself, or like, I'm not good enough. I can be better. And I should pressure myself. And I have that struggle with some of my students. I want them to feel good about where they are. But at the same time, also getting paid to teach is like saying, you can be better, which means I'm telling them they're not good enough. And I always struggle with that.
I feel like our language could be better when it comes to those terms. I feel like there should be a word that means this middle ground of being good enough, but also has room to strive for excellence. Mm-hmm. And we kind of don't have that word or that phrase or whatever it is. I feel like there's that gap.
Yeah.
I don't know. Maybe it's not the language, but it feels that way in the moment right now.
There's got to be something in German, because if it's not in English, it's always in German. They've got a word that means some random emotion. And you're like, that's what this means? This is what I've been missing my whole life? I need this.
Or it could be a combination of so many words that it's just hard to know what it really means. But yes, this the feeling good about where I am. And when I got my job in Arkansas, I was in Austin, Texas. And my parents, especially who are still in Japan, said, where? And I said, well, in the map, US map, I'm going right in the middle. I'm going to the center of United States. And they said, why? And Because it, you know, it was going to be even further to travel from Japan, and you know, for them it was an unknown. For me, it was a little bit unknown too. But now I really am. I feel fortunate that I ended up in Northwestern Arkansas. Like you said, I've been here for 12 years, and every year there's something new, and I feel like there's such great growth. There's a great art museum, there's a good concert series, and there is a sort of energy, and of course there's more, it's a growing area. There's many people moving into this area all the time. So almost every month I meet a new musician or musician who relocated from somewhere, and now I feel like, oh, I need to create more opportunities. I need to figure out how we can bring everybody together, and I don't know, have a healthy community where we can actually play with music. So that has been kind of my a passion project in the recent years, figuring out how to create this community where people come and sight read, make mistakes, and have a good laugh, and say, see you next time. And it has been growing, so I'm really fortunate to be here.
Sandra in our chat said, Crystal Bridges. Does that mean something to you?
Yes, Crystal Bridges is a museum. It is founded by Alice Walton, one of the Walton
Oh, yeah.
family. It's a great museum. It's free. It has a great permanent collection of American art, as well as temporary exhibitions. They have also a really nice concert hall. They acquired piano that used to belong to Van Cliburn. So we have they host Van Cliburn piano series, which has been bringing many great artists to Crystal Bridges.
Very nice.
That reminds me of the space that we would perform in Nebraska. Shout out to anybody listening in Lincoln, Nebraska. There's an on-site art museum that has this incredible acoustic space right in the main lobby, but a lot of permanent things and permanent exhibits that come in. But one of the things that was so attractive about that space and was that they would invite various music groups to come in, typically chamber works, to come into the space, help promote that, but then get people invested in both the art in their exhibit halls as well as the art inside of the main lobby that was being performed. And most often it would tie together in some capacity. For me, when I was looking at some of the works that you're doing with chamber music of the Ozarks, you're looking to bring chamber music to different spaces within your community. Can you talk to us a little bit about why that's a passion of yours, and what are some places that people may not expect to see chamber music being performed?
Actually, the very origin of chamber music, chamber is a small room. It goes way back to like 1700s. So a lot many chamber music repertoire pieces written in the smaller ensemble group setting was intended to be played in, you know, like somebody's living room. They have a gathering, and you know, it's three people. I don't want to say a dinner party entertainment, but kind of yes. A lot of composers would have friends premiere works. They had soirées, so you know, they will get together and they premiere works. So I think the somewhere, of course, in the you know hundreds of years, and it there the chair is the music became a little bit of a detached. I feel like especially classical music, it became so far from everyday life. It became kind of a detached, I guess, from people. And now especially, there's so many genres of music. There's so many, you know, options. There's so many. And I think the variety is great, but I wanted to bring chamber music or classical music a little bit closer, back into people's lives, and not have to feel like, oh, you need to dress up to go to a classical music concert, or you need to not clap in between pieces. I think those things happen because if people are excited that you play such a, enthusiastic, and people are excited to then move to clap, I don't think it's a thing somebody has to feel ashamed or scared of. But that became a certain, I don't know, stigma, I think, for classical music. So chamber music for me is, like you said, it's conversational, it's more intimate, it's smaller ensemble. I feel like most of the best chamber music experience I've had personally is when I can actually hear people, like the musicians, breathe. You're in the space with them. So I'm still looking for places, but I would love to do house concerts. It's not maybe the biggest money making, maybe it's not the best business model, but it's the best music experience model, I think. Some of the places that I've taken my chamber music ensemble has been, of course, public library is a great place. Anybody's welcome. We've had, little kids too, of course, parents and whoever was in the library just kind of stopped by for a few pieces, and if they didn't feel like they wanted to stay, they're welcome to walk out. We've had some concerts, especially there's a summer festival with chamber music that I host. We've had some concerts in a former smokehouse, I guess. So kind of like a restaurant bar setting, with a low ceiling, and there's some unique decor. It's owned by a family here in town, and it feels like it should be a country or bluegrass band venue. But we played some Dvorak, we played some serious, serious in compositional, how well crafted they are. But why not in a smokehouse? I think it actually, the audience who came there, they had pizzas and they had drinks, and we talked about music and we played it seriously, and they enjoyed it. We enjoyed it, and it was like one of the best chamber music experience. Maybe we had like 30 people,
Nice.
so we can actually see that us as a music on the stage, we can also see how they're reacting, and it kind of, creates even more energy because you can really feel each other in that small of a space. We've had performances at actually Crystal Bridges Great Hall, and it has a beautiful glass window overlooking these water features. And we for that concert, because of Crystal Bridges and the art museum being the art, I selected a piece by Jennifer Higdon, who is a composer out in East Coast. And she had a piece for a piano trio that was about different paintings by American painters. So I did a concert where we kind of paired their permanent collection, paintings to the pieces that we're playing. And that was kind of fun too. It's always nice to have a theme to kind of figure out the programs. I think one of the most important thing, especially for the summer festival that I organize called Chamber Music on the Mountain, I try to partner with a nonprofit arts organization for each summer. So not this past summer, but 2 summers ago, I partnered with the Jazz Society of Northwest Arkansas. We did the kind of like a split concert where we played chamber music inspired by jazz. So a lot of the pieces had jazz style, but
Wow.
it was definitely classical. But it had rhythms or certain aspects of jazz influence into the repertoire. And then the Jazz Society played pieces that was original, sorry, classical origin, jazz repertoire with classical origin. Wow. So they had some arrangements of like Ravel music, and it was very cool. We did that kind of like a side-by-side concert, and it was a lot of fun putting that together.
That sounds fabulous.
I have more fun thinking about what to partner with, because, you know, of course, that gives me a chance to research, like if I wanted to partner with jazz. Or this past summer, I partnered with the Ozark History Museum. So I wanted to bring out, like, you know, what's native to Arkansas or in the Ozarks. So the Ozark History Museum, Shiloh Museum, had some dancers. I did a little Google search and I found out that there's a group who focuses on sharing dance forms that was popular in Ozarks in the 1800s. So they did some dance routines in the public library. They showed us some moves, and we played some music that kind of paired nicely with that. We brought the same music out to a botanical garden. So it was outside, it was hot. It was very, very hot. But after our part of the concert, the dancers came and showed the dance move, and we all actually joined and we had a little dance off session. That was very fun too.
Yeah. That sounds fabulous. I love the innovation that you're into and in collaborating with different groups like that and making those really interesting and unique events happen.
I enjoy it a lot.
Yeah.
I hope you come sometime.
I would love to. We owe Sandra a visit anyway. And
great.
There's so many people in Arkansas we need to visit now. I feel like we should do something to make that happen. We were going to last year. And what, Trey?
Roadshow.
Yeah. We'll just stream live from the back seat of my car. We'll get Josh to drive, and Sandra said, "Yes, you do. Yes, we do. I know. Do you because this is, I love that you keep your job fresh and through these collaborations and your innovation, and I think that's something that is probably necessary for a lot of jobs. I feel like a lot of people get stuck or get bored, and I could see how you could easily, I maybe not easily, that's probably not the right word, but you can play at what you do to create new things, and that keeps it exciting. But I want to know if there's anything that makes you like fall in love with piano all over again. Is there anything that gives you that like original passion back and you're like, yeah, I'm in the right place?
Yeah, I'm in the right place for sure. I think, I don't know, I remember still the music that gave me goosebumps.
Yeah.
I'm sure I wasn't, playing it overly passionate or something, but there are some moments when you really feel like the music elevates what you're feeling inside. So it just, you know, the right background music for the perfect movie scene kind of thing. It just kind of enhances the experience. And for me, especially since I've become collaboratively inclined and I play with many people, there are moments where I feel like I am such a integral part of what they're experiencing. My playing, and of course we complete each other. And there are moments where you just feel it and you go like, oh, I need that one more time. And I think I keep searching for the next moment of like, wow, that just felt right. And I don't know if this answers your question in terms of piano. But for me, piano is I'm glad that I ended up being a pianist, because piano is, I can play with anybody. if I was a cellist, of course, there's music that is cello and violin, a part of quartet, but piano is such a versatile instrument. I can play with a singer, I can play with a string. And so I feel like I got so lucky being a pianist who ended up loving playing with people. And I have this tool that allows me to just be involved in so many people's music making and life. Sometimes it's a little bit too much and I will say, turn it off. I'm done. I'm done. So to go kind of backwards from what you said, there are moments where I need to turn off the music.
Sure.
But many times I do feel like, wow, this is why. And it's not a certain piece, but it's just one of those moments where you know that you're there and, you know, connecting with whoever you're playing with. I get goosebumps.
With all of the different music that's out there, especially chamber works, I think we have a benefit of seeing many new composers writing pieces, but they're not often widespread. Do you have any recommendations for people to get into newer music or to hear composers' works that are not often performed?
That's a great, of course, there are people who kind of specialize. There are groups who commissions all the time. And I guess it depends on if your access point, if you're really into piano as your main the instrument that you enjoy the most, or if you enjoy strings. And there's so many really good composers out there. So I can't say there is one channel podcast that you can really tune into and say, this is all the new things. But I'm glad that many music productions, like I can't say CD companies, because there's, you don't know what, some of the kids don't know what CDs are anymore, but there are still Naxos, which, if you remember, that was a CD company that really focused on providing platform for artists to feature a certain composer. And there used to be a complete of Villalobos, or this, you know, our music from Argentina, that kind of collection.
Yeah.
So if you go into that kind of websites, they now focus, there are many companies like that who focus on highlighting, you know, underrepresented composers, composers from areas that hasn't been featured before, or new compositions. And there are so many different series kind of like that. And so, yeah, I think that's a nice way to kind of search if you go to a bigger platform and see if you can find series. I love working with composers who are still writing. This is, as a performer, we get to ask them questions. I have contacted some composers saying, what were you thinking? What were you thinking here? How can I play this better? I need to understand what you wanted from this. And most of the time, it's composers who are really willing. They're super helpful and say, you know, sometimes they say, do what you think is the best, because they've given us that license to read what they had provided and kind of figure out what we want to say with it.
Yeah.
Or some composers will actually say, well, when I wrote this, I was thinking about, you know, stars, or I was, you know, having this thought of image in my head and I wanted to create this kind of world. And so that's sometimes helpful. Yeah, so I'm not sure if I answered your question directly, Trey, because there's so many different ways to approach. But one thing for sure, composers who are creating new works now, the more we support them by playing or listening or reaching out to them and say, hey, I think your music sounds cool, you know, where else can I hear your music? I think that would lead to a more buried programming in the future. I feel bad in a way because I heard somebody say that the value of the composition goes higher when the composer passes and they've written their last note in a way. But there's still a lot of live composers who are alive and who we can, like you said, interact with and bring their, music to concerts already. So, there's always more that we can enjoy.
I feel like it's so valuable to be able to contact a composer and ask those questions. What were you thinking in this part of the song, or what were you trying to portray, or what vision did you have? I think that's amazing. I remember taking an English class in college and we were reading the poetry of people who had passed, like famous poems, or like Emily Dickinson, she's no longer around, or various poets, and we're reading it kind of guessing what some of the things they meant in the poetry. We sort of don't always know what it was because they're gone. If they didn't talk about it, or if it's not recorded somewhere where they explained it, then that's all we have to go on. So I think it's fabulous that you have that ability to contact the composer and learn those things. And the composer's vision has a better chance of being heard the way they wanted it to.
I see there's a question.
Yes.
May I read?
You may, yes.
It says, have you ever recorded your own music, or are you more of a live performer? I so wish that I can compose, but I am a performer. I have recorded, but not my own, a piece that I've composed myself. I think that has a little bit to do with the training, because I have been taught to read from the beginning of my piano learning or music learning. And sometimes I am jealous of my students, especially from this area. There are many students in Arkansas who's trained by ear. They sang in choir, they played for the church, they kind of figured out their way. So it's really hard for me to teach them sometimes to read music, but when it comes to just kind of hearing and playing around a melody or improvising on it, they're really more natural at. And I wish that I had that more as my own experience when I was growing up. But I, like you said, I from the beginning I was reading music and recreating. So what I usually end up telling my students a lot is we are like actors. We have a script. We have notations that tells us what to play. But how we play the notes is literally like live actors in a theater. There's so many ways to phrase. Of course, there's clues in the music that kind of underlines the emotion or where it's leading to. And as a performer or actor, we know where we're going, but we can't show it yet because we're doing it for the audience and they don't know that yet.
Right.
And so we're always kind of figuring out this, how to create this flow for our listeners, the audience, or whoever is having to sit and listen to me to say, just kind of build up to that moment of this, heartbreak or great joy. And so in a way, like you said, I don't create my music, but I also feel like every time I know the notes that I'm going to play, but I don't know, I'm not a performer who plans every single detail, if that makes sense. There's, of course, set things like the notes or the length of the notes that's already given to me by the composer.
Mm-hmm.
But then on a sunny day in this room versus a rainy, cold day, I might feel just slightly different. So the timing or some of the nuances would change. And I think that's, the beauty of live performance. When we record, it becomes set and permanent. So I feel like it's somewhere in the middle. I want to to be a little bit more flexible than,
I have never really thought about music being like actors on a stage or in that capacity, but I can definitely see that. And that really resonates with me. My other thought is, my question for you is there a piece that you look back on and every time you perform it, you are like, yes, I can come back to this. Like chefs making a dish that's their staple dish. If someone were to come to you and then say, what's the piece that you're just like, yes, I can knock this out of the park, eyes closed, what would that be?
don't know. There are pieces that I definitely enjoy playing every single time I play it. I love collaborating with all instruments. I love working with singers, but I am definitely more, I guess, in tune with string players. I had many players, especially cellists that I worked with when I was in undergraduate. And one of those goosebump moments was when I was playing a Brahms cello sonata with a friend of mine. Every time I come back to it, it gives me a goosebump. So, I would never turned down playing that piece. I was like, yes, please. Can I play with you again? Can I play that piece again? I don't know. The solo pieces, since I became the main difference, I should say, I guess, the expectation, and this could be changing, especially with technology. Don't tell this to my students or any music students who are in college, because the expectation for solo pianists are to have their piano pieces memorized. And I think there's a certain reason. We play 88 keys with 10 fingers, and they're, pretty wide, so there's a lot of movement. And so certain things are easier if you have the notes in your head and you can watch your hand, so you have better aim, per se, to not miss a note. If you're always staring at the music, of course, you're not able to see where your hands are going. So I think, for sure, memorizing frees your eyes to see where you're going, or having that music already in your head keeps you focused in a certain way. But for many people, memorization, including myself, I struggled with memorizing all my life. I had to come up with every trick that I could think of, playing it in my head, writing it down, really focusing and saying the notes out loud, and just kind of really drilling all those things. And still, in the moment of performance and you're in front of people, it's kind of like you know your name, but when you're suddenly looking at 1,000 people, you might see your name in a funny way. And I think it's kind of the same thing. And many, many solo pianists have the fear of being on stage, because what if, what if I forget what I'm playing, or what if I, become so nervous that I can't remember. And so many of us have stage fright, many of us have that anxiety, leading up to a solo performance, thinking, we have all this nightmare stories
Course,
about,
yeah.
things. So now I've one of the beauty about collaborative piano, I can openly say I will always play with music just in case something happens. And pianist is the only one who has everybody else's part. When we're playing a trio, for instance, I'm playing with a violinist and a cellist. Violinist is only looking at the violin part, cellist is only looking at cello part. But for piano, we have the score, meaning I have the violin part, cello part, and the piano
Oh.
part. So if somebody gets off, I'm the only one who would know. Or I mean, I have the parts in front of me. So, now I can openly say I'm supposed to play with music, and that gives me a little bit of, blanket, of not having to memorize my parts. Right. But in a way, I also have to memorize how my violinist part sounds like in case it gets off. I'm also listening to my cellist part saying like, oh, are we all together? So even though I'm not memorizing my piano part to play without the score, I'm actually also now in charge of how the violin, or I'm, at least I'm aware of how it should sound. I'm also, you know, keeping my ears. So the rules change a little bit in how we our participation changes, I think, in ensemble. But I surely don't miss having to feel the anxiety or the fear of not knowing what to play in a solo situation. Now we use iPad, I have a Bluetooth pedal that changes, flips the pages. So even when I play solo, I know it's like the best thing.
That's amazing.
That's great.
So I haven't played, well, I still once in a while play solo music, and I don't need the music because I feel connected, or I want to challenge myself to see if I can really have digest the music enough to, that it's already inside of me. But a lot of times now with job, I teach at the university and I do all these things. I don't have the luxury of time anymore as much as I used to, and maybe that's, you know, something I could work on, or I should work on. When I was pursuing undergraduate in piano performance, I worked toward this 45-minute recital for the whole year. You know, I worked little by little and memorizing this one Beethoven sonata, another Chopin piece, another piece, and then you work toward this one thing. But right now, as a collaborative pianist, my turnaround is about 2 to 3 weeks. I'm learning something new all the time. Wow. So I don't have the time to, maybe I need to plan a little bit longer time, but sometimes we don't get the music until a month before the concert. And so I'm having to learn something very quickly. So, you know, nothing is perfect. I wish, I guess I shouldn't wish. I'm glad that there's people ask me to play with them, and I can figure out a way to learn and still have rehearsal. But sometimes it's a different stress, if a different challenge. So I wish I have a piece where I can sit down and play, you know, from memory at any occasion. I have like a short piece that I use as a warm-up that I've been playing since I was like 12 years old or something like that. But, you know, it's not a concert piece where I would be entertainment or something. I would think about that for the next time.
When you were talking about forgetting things, I will never forget this. I was singing Fiocca la Neve at a Nats competition. And it was the regional Nats. So if you won something there, you actually got prize money. Like if you placed, you got some level of prize money. So it kind of was a big deal. And I remember standing on the stage in Denver, Colorado, looking out at my three judges that were sitting in the very back behind all the lights. So I really couldn't see them. And I got to the end of the song, and there's this really long interlude that happens. And I forgot the last line of text.
Oh.
God bless my my collaborative pianist during that, because he vamped and he added things that I have never heard for before in that song. But he was so good, and he whispered out the last line of text to me where the judges couldn't hear me. And then I was able to get through to the end of that song.
Wow.
It happens, and sure, much like we said at the beginning of this podcast, mistakes happen, and we are humans, and we make mistakes. However, I would like to also share that I won that competition that year. So I still came in first in my division, even though I forgot the last line of text.
Wow, what a story. That's awesome.
So, that being said, mistakes can happen, and it can happen at the worst time, but even so, you still persevere.
And that means you were very musical, because that mistake did not take away from you being awarded. That means you were a very musical performer in that competition.
Well, thank you. The judges still noticed because they knew that piece in and out. And they still said, you should probably review this a little bit more. But that being said, so no, they still knew, but they were still very, very kind about it.
What was it? What was the piece?
Fioca la Neve. The piece, Pietro Cimara. It's a really beautiful Italian art song. It's depressing as all get out if you translate it, but it's beautiful. And I love the way that he styles that. Anyway, that is a diatribe for another time. Tomoko, I have one final question for you. And it is, if anyone is wanting to get into music, more specifically piano, what advice do you have for them?
If they have not played in this, if they really want to play piano, go for it. I think piano is one of the most accessible instrument. The pitches are there. It's you can see what you're going to hear almost, you know, like violin or singing, you can't really see how you produce your sound. But for piano, you can see, you can almost learn by, even for yourself, maybe not all the technical things. I believe that all pianists or any musician should be a good singer at heart. If you can sing the melody in your heart and try to put that into, you know, matching how it comes from the piano, I think anybody can be, sing through their instrument, the piano. Find a teacher, if you can, who understands what you want to do with it. I don't think everybody needs to become a concert pianist. I think music can be in our lives at any stage in any amount, even if you are only wanting to play, I don't know, Beatles song because you really loved it and it brings you joy, you can find a teacher who can help you find the right arrangement that you can play. There are so many ways to keep music in life. And if you're ready to play piano, there's even really good digital piano. You don't even need acoustic piano if you don't have space. If you need to just have a headphone so nobody's hearing you playing wrong notes, that's okay. And then, you know, when you're ready to share with somebody, unplug the headphone or find an upright piano or somewhere and, you know, go. I mean, I don't think there's anything you can do wrong, you know. And like you said at the beginning, I really do believe music can be enjoyed and should be part of everybody's life, whether it's just learning piano for the first time at age 60. I've had that before. Like I said, that is just an example. Somebody really wanted to play Yesterday by Beatles has happened in my past, and they just wanted to be able to play. So I found the music with big notes and, you know, just put finger numbering on it. So they didn't even need to learn how to read music at that point. They just matched the numbers and still was able to play. And I think that's not wrong. You know, how to learn how to play an instrument. I don't think there's one way. So, yeah, I think the only thing you have to do is find a piano and start plunking on it and see how it goes.
I love that. And what a great suggestion that you can use technology to your advantage by using headphones and an electronic keyboard or electronic piano. That's what a great suggestion. I wish I had thought of that. Why didn't I think of that, Trey?
I don't know. I have the answers to all your problems.
We do everything else with headphones so nobody else hears. Why not that? And especially because you can. They're not every instrument, maybe. I don't know. Is every instrument now electronicized? Do they have... Probably not.
No, actually, if you're a flute player, I don't know of an electronic flute or clarinet. But right. For piano, you know, you can kind of still do it, you know, in the privacy. Even if you're in the middle of somebody's house, you can just go boop and, you know, have at it.
Brilliant. What does that look on your face, Trey?
Her saying electronic flute, I had to Google that to see if there is one.
Is there one?
There, I don't know if it would be what we consider a flute, but there are flute adjacent electronic devices.
Do they have? It's weird because I don't want there to be a cord. That should have a cord.
I don't know. There is something on the internet calling itself an electronic flute, but it looks more like they're playing it like a clarinet.
Oh.
But I do see something off to the right here. I'm not going to click on it at the moment. But it does look like a flute, and it does look electronic, but I will explore that at a later time.
I think I will have to do that too, because that could invite some more people to play music.
Yeah.
And, you know, who knows? I mean, technology sometimes, I mean, not always, but may often helps us, you know, experience things that we might not have been able to without it. So, great. Yeah. Well, I'm glad you looked, Trey. Thank you.
You're welcome. Tomoko, before we wrap this today's episode, I want to make sure that our listening audience can stay in touch with you and that anyone who's interested can go see your concert series. Do you have any social media that you would like our listening audience to follow you at?
Sure. Right now, if you are interested in coming to Fayetteville, Arkansas, it's a beautiful place. And if you would like to come hear some of the concerts, the organization is called Chamber Music of the Ozarks. The website is cmozarks.org. I think if you Google it, I think I've done enough. Hopefully I do website and things, and I'm not very good at it, but it is on the web, on the Google search. So if you Google Chamber Music of the Ozarks, it should pop up. The same name goes for Facebook and Instagram. I'm not very good at social media. It's probably the most stressful part of this whole new projects and endeavor. I'm hoping to have some more people help me out because I'd rather be playing the piano.
I definitely get that, yes.
But yes, please look us up, and I would love if you are listening to this and if you end up coming, please let me know, because this was my first appearance on the podcast, so I didn't know what to expect. But Emily and Trey has been so great, and I would love to hear from anybody who ended up coming to concerts because of this. I would love to know about it.
Thank you, and we'll have to come and see you as well.
Yes, thank you. Please do.
Well, as we wrap up this episode, I want to give a humongous thank you to Tomoko for being on the episode with us here today. You were fantastic. Would you consider being on the podcast again?
Absolutely. Thank you so much.
That would be fabulous. Yes.
Yes. As we wrap up, this episode, along with probably every episode for now and forever, will be dedicated to Joe Capone, our fellow moderator, comedian, passionate encourager, and greatly missed friend. You can follow us on social media under Modern Romantic for updates, announcements, and more. Follow us there. And you can also find us pretty much wherever you tune into podcasts. Thanks, everybody. And remember, go practice your scales. Thanks. Have a great day.